Philosophy of Mind, Lecture 13, Mind-Body Causation, Part 2.
In the last lecture, we finished up our discussion of qualia and their relationship to the physical world after having explored four different arguments that qualia resist accommodation by purely physicalist accounts of the world. The question under investigation there was primarily whether qualia are physical things or instead are irreducibly mental in nature. One aspect of their relationship to the physical world which we did not discuss was their causal relationship, and so we return in this lecture to the topic we first introduced back in Lecture 7, namely the problem of mind-body causation. In that lecture, recall, we first saw how the idea of there being causal relations between the mental and the physical was simultaneously obvious, important, and problematic. It was problematic because on the Cartesian dualist picture, where mind and body are completely different sorts of substances, it seemed unintelligible how the non-spatial mind could have causal interactions with the spatial body or brain. But as we'll see, especially later in this lecture, it's problematic even if you don't lean towards Descartes' own substance dualism, and instead prefer some more contemporary formulation such as property dualism, a view according to which mental properties cannot be reduced to or identified with physical properties, even if we grant that the same physical brain could have both sorts of properties. For there, the problem is in precisely how to insert the mental properties into what seems to be the purely physical causal operations of the brain. It surely looks, according to science, that one physical state of the brain causes the next physical state of the brain. But then what precisely could mental properties contribute to that picture? Earlier, we focused primarily on the Cartesian substance dualism form of the mind-body causation problem, looking at what 17th century thinkers like Descartes, Nicolas Malebranche, and G.W. Leibniz said about mind-body causation. In this lecture, we'll bring things up to the present day, exploring how the problem of mind-body causation seems to remain largely unsolved, even though it's taking on some new forms. We begin with a position which recognizes the problem head-on. T.H. Huxley and Descartes' mechanical conception of animals. Thomas Henry Huxley, lived in the 19th century, was an English biologist, anatomist, and paleontologist, and was widely known as Darwin's bulldog for his advocacy of Charles Darwin's then newly discovered theory of evolution. His interest in animals led him to examine, in a famous article, one of Descartes' own less famous, but perhaps most infamous, doctrines, the idea that non-human animals are mere automatons, meaning thereby that they lacked all sensations, awareness, feelings, consciousness. In fact, that monstrous thesis, as it's been called, follows fairly straightforwardly from some otherwise very compelling parts of Descartes' overall philosophy, but that's a topic for another course. For our purposes, we'll examine the rather midway position on the issue that Huxley develops in his response to Descartes. The starting point is the recognition that purely physical science can explain an awful lot about animal behavior. Descartes believed this in the 17th century, and Huxley notes that it's all the more true in the late 19th century as biology unraveled more and more of the secrets of how animals work. And no doubt, we might add, it's all the more true today in the 21st century when we could add in our understanding of anatomy, biochemistry, genetics, and so forth. This fact naturally raises the question of whether everything an animal does, it does purely because of its purely physical structure, without its being conscious or having mental states playing any role at all in its behavior. Well, Huxley notes, we cannot definitely prove that animals lack all consciousness, but then again, we can't prove definitively either that they do have consciousness, for consciousness is not the sort of thing, as we've seen since Lecture 1, whose presence can be directly known by any being other than its possessor. But since we ourselves are clearly conscious, he says, and we ourselves have mental states in general, and since he finds what he calls the doctrine of continuity, the idea that no complex natural phenomena ever springs suddenly into existence, but rather arises gradually and continuously, since he finds that doctrine extremely well established, the weight of the evidence seems in favor of the hypothesis that animals are indeed possessed of mentality, even if in some simpler form than our own, or so Huxley concludes. But then what about the idea that animal behavior can be explained without invoking their mentality, without making reference to their consciousness and mental states? Huxley writes, quote, We believe of lower animals, in short, that they are machines, one part of which, the nervous system, not only sets the rest in motion, but is provided with special apparatus, the function of which is the calling into existence of those states of consciousness which are termed sensations, emotions, and ideas. End quote. So Huxley holds, animals are machines, and their brains both run their bodies as well as produce states of consciousness. So far, so good, except that what are these states of consciousness for exactly, if their brains in fact mechanically run their bodies all on their own? Huxley writes, quote, "Molecular changes in the brain are the causes of all the states of consciousness of brutes, animals. Is there any evidence that these states of consciousness might conversely cause those molecular changes which give rise to muscular motion? I see no such evidence. The consciousness of brutes would appear to be related to the mechanism of their body simply as a collateral product of its working, and to be as completely without any power of modifying that working as the steam whistle which accompanies the work of a locomotive engine is without influence upon its machinery." End quote. So there you have it. The physical activities of the brain are completely responsible for the behavior of animals and produce all of the animals' corresponding mental states. But, and here's the key part, the mental states themselves, the consciousness, cause and do absolutely nothing. They are mere byproducts of the working of the brain, as the sound of the steam whistle in Huxley's 19th century metaphor is the byproduct of the locomotive, and itself causally contributes nothing to the workings of the engine. So animals are conscious, but their consciousness is causally inefficacious, inert, powerless. It's real, but it does nothing. Human beings and epiphenomenalism. But Huxley doesn't stop there. In a suddenly cautious tone, he continues, you can almost imagine a whisper, quote, "It's quite true, to the best of my judgment, the argumentation which applies to brutes holds equally good of human beings," end quote. And that leads us to the first position of this lecture. According to epiphenomenalism, mental and physical states and properties are equally real. And while mental events, say, may well be caused by physical events, they themselves are mere epiphenomena, i.e. events without any genuine causal powers of their own, and hence they themselves cause nothing. Causation is all one way. Mental events are purely effects of physical events and never causes of anything. So consider then an alleged case of mental causation and mind-body causation, which we've talked about previously. You feel the searing pain of a toothache, which causes in you, allegedly, the mental desire for a painkiller, which causes you physically to take some painkiller. According to the epiphenomenalist, this causal language is out of place here. Rather, all the causing is done by the purely physical brain or states of the brain. The state of the brain at one time causes the searing pain, at the next time it causes in you the desire to take a painkiller, and at the next time it causes your body to move in pursuit of the painkiller. The mental phenomena are produced by the brain, in correlation perhaps with what's going on physically, but they themselves don't cause or do anything. All true causation is at the lower, more fundamental level, the level of the physical brain. So the epiphenomenalist is willing to grant at least one-way causation, from the physical to the mental. But the exciting and controversial part of the thesis is, of course, the denial of the causation from the other direction, from the mental to the physical. The mental is causally inert. Epiphenomenalism does seem, admittedly, to nicely fit the facts. Science strongly suggests that our behavior can be entirely explained in physical terms, that is to say, in terms of the brain operating and controlling the body, and yet we're obviously aware of our conscious mental states. The position remains quite problematic. First, it does grant that the physical can cause the mental, so there's no unbridgeable gap between them, in which case why exactly couldn't or doesn't the mental also cause the physical? But second, more importantly, something seems wrong to many philosophers with stripping the mental of all causal power altogether. It seems to some, for example, that nothing could exist without having some causal powers or influence. Being real and having effects on other things seem bound together, and so to deny causal powers to the mental would seem to deny it of any reality whatsoever. Indeed, if the mental has no causal power at all, then it wouldn't make any difference to the world whatsoever if mental states existed or not. And not only would we lose all reason to think that other human beings truly have minds, since their behavior would be exactly the same whether or not they were conscious, but it would also be a mystery why natural selection might select for the development of mentality. Having a mind, thoughts, beliefs, sensations, could confer no survival or reproductive advantage on the animals which have it, and thus natural selection would never produce such beings. And that would make the existence of the mind extremely mysterious, miraculous, in fact, since it would be open to no natural explanation. So it seems we should continue searching for some more attractive position here. Let's jump ahead a century, in fact, to the work on mind-body causation of University of California, Berkeley philosopher Donald Davidson. Donald Davidson and two theses about mind-body causation. For our current purposes, we'll set aside Descartes' substance dualism in favor of something like property dualism. Our causation problem, then, will not be how non-spatial minds interact with spatial brains, but rather how mental properties and events, even if they occur in physical brains, enter into causal relations with physical properties and events. And this problem is made more difficult by two now widely accepted general theses about causation and the relationship between the mental and the physical. Davidson enters our story here precisely because of his introducing these theses to the discussion and in his attempted solution of the resulting mind-body causation problem. Here are the two key theses. Number one, causation, it is thought, involves laws connecting causes and effects. And thesis number two, there are no such laws connecting the mental and the physical. Thesis two is sometimes referred to as the anomalism of the mental. The phrase comes from the Greek word nomos for law, and it means literally the lawlessness of the mental, the idea that there are no laws governing mental processes and events, and in particular, governing the relationship between mental and physical. We'll elaborate on both of these theses in a moment, but from the start, it should be clear why they generate a problem for mind-body causation. If causation requires laws, as the first thesis says, and there are no laws between the mental and physical, as the second thesis says, then it follows that there can be no causation between the two either. So let's now turn to some elaboration. Thesis 1. Causation involves laws connecting causes and effects. We talked briefly about the idea of laws in Lecture 10's discussion of the causal covariance theory of meaning. And while a philosophy of science course would be the place for a more thorough discussion, here we'll briefly sketch why many philosophers think that laws are an important part of the idea of causation in general. Consider a simple example of causation. Heating a certain metal causes the metal to expand. Now the thought here is that if the heating genuinely causes the expansion, there must be a general law, a law of nature, connecting those two events. Something of the form, heating certain metals in certain ways always leads to their expansion. Causation doesn't merely link individual events, in other words. Rather, it's only because an event is of a certain general type that it's able to cause events of other types. And once you invoke types, as you might recall from Lecture 4's discussion of the type identity theory, then you're talking about whole classes or categories of events. So it's not merely that this heating event here and now causes this particular individual expansion event. It's that, in general, heatings bring about expansions. Now, why should we believe that causation involves or requires such general laws? Imagine some individual event, an X, being closely followed by some other individual event, a Y. Let's say X is the heating of this piece of metal here and now, and Y is the subsequent expansion of that piece of metal. The fact that they're closely conjoined may suggest that there's a causal relationship between them. But now imagine that we have another individual event exactly like X, but it isn't followed by a Y. We heat another identical piece of metal in the same circumstances, only it doesn't expand. If that were to occur, we would probably revisit that first pair of events and question whether there really was a causal relationship between them. Perhaps it was just random that the heating was followed by the expansion in the first case. Perhaps some other factor was present in the first case but absent in the second, of which we're unaware, which was itself the cause of the expansion. So the point, in short, is that unless events like X are always followed by events like Y, we wouldn't think of X as causing Y. But that's just to say that causation always involves laws between general types of events. X's are always followed by Y's. This brings us to thesis 2, the anomalism of the mental, the lawlessness of the mental. This again is the claim that there are no such laws connecting mental events or properties and physical events or properties. The question now is why we should believe this to be true. Davidson offers a famous argument for the anomalism of the mental, focusing on intentional states. It's famous, and it's generated a large literature discussing it, because it seems connected to so many important ideas. It might, for example, undermine the type identity theory we talked about in Lecture 4, it might support the externalism about mental content we talked about in Lecture 10, and it might even ultimately support denying the reality of the mental altogether, which we'll address in our next and final lecture. Here, we'll briefly sketch a version of the argument, and we'll frame it as a response to this question. Is it plausible to hold that mental states are correlated with underlying neural states, which as a matter of law suffice for them? Or to put that a little bit more plainly, is it plausible to hold that all the people who have a particular specific intentional state, such as a particular specific belief, say the belief that dogs are mammals, also might share the same particular specific neural structure and activity? Or to put that in our current language, is it plausible to hold that all who possess the mental property of believing that dogs are mammals also must possess, by virtue of a law connecting them, the physical property of being in a particular specific brain state? Here's why Davidson says no. Why you should accept the anomalism of the mental. Here's why. Because how we ascribe intentional states to people differs in important ways from how we ascribe physical states, such as brain states, and in such a way as to rule out the possibility of there being any laws connecting physical states to mental states. To see what this means, let's consider how we ascribe intentional states to people. Similarly to Daniel Dennett's intentional stance theory from Lecture 8, Davidson suggests that the ascription process is deeply regulated by principles of rationality, which ensure that the total set of intentional states we ascribe to an individual are as rational and coherent as possible. So, for example, we refrain from ascribing contradictory beliefs to people unless the evidence is such that we must take them to believe a contradiction. If you ask someone, "Hey, do you like Fred?" and they say, "Well, I do and I don't," you don't take them to contradict themselves even when what they assert seems explicitly to be a contradiction. Rather, you take them to mean that they like him in some respects but do not like him in other respects. Maybe they like his sense of humor but dislike his arrogance. Davidson even suggests that in order to take someone to be speaking meaningfully, to be uttering meaningful sentences, we must take them to have a consistent and reasonably coherent set of beliefs without contradictions. For were someone to insist that he both believes and disbelieves the very same thing, we would have no choice but to conclude that he doesn't mean anything by his words, since what he utters is literally nonsense. So overall, then, when determining what someone believes, we're sensitive to the rational principle of avoiding contradictions. But there's more. We also tend to ascribe to people beliefs that follow logically from other beliefs we've ascribed to them, even when we lack further explicit evidence that they have these other beliefs. Thus, if someone believes that Providence is less than 50 miles from Boston, we also take them to believe that it's less than 100 miles from Boston, even if they've never said anything to this effect. Put most generally, Davidson's point is that before we ascribe any given belief, we must take into account the numerous other things the person believes. We can't simply ascribe to Fred some technical physics belief unless he has many other beliefs about math and physics. Joanne might assert Obama is president, but we can't take her to believe that Obama is president unless she has many other beliefs about, say, current events and what constitutes being a president and who Obama is and so forth. For imagine she asserted this, and we followed up by asking, "Well, what is a president?" And she said either, "Well, I don't know," or "It's a kind of vegetable." We would clearly hesitate to say she believes that Obama is president simply because she doesn't have the concept of a president, the concept the having of which requires having numerous other beliefs. So the ascription of intentional states in general is a holistic process. We don't and cannot have intentional states individually, one by one, in isolation from each other. We only have them in large sets, and determining just which particular intentional states a person has is a matter of looking at very large whole sets of their intentional states. So what does this have to do with the possibility of laws connecting the mental and the physical? It's this. Ascribing physical or neural states to individuals is under no such holistic constraints. We may ascribe neural states one by one, so to speak. The person is in this brain state, now in another brain state, and so on, without any need to make these states cohere with each other. Individual neural states, in other words, are very well defined and can occur, in effect, independently of each other. But now suppose that there were a law connecting the mental and the neural, a law that said that whenever this brain state occurs, then that intentional state occurs as well. If so, then whenever that brain state did occur, so would the corresponding intentional state, and there would be no need to ascribe the latter holistically. If there were such laws, in other words, then intentional states could also be ascribed one by one independently of each other. But that, of course, is precisely what we cannot do, according to Davidson's argument. The very nature of intentional states is that you cannot have one without having many other related ones. So if Davidson is right about the holistic nature of the way we ascribe intentional states, then there simply could not be one-to-one relationships between intentional states and any underlying brain states. But to say that is just to say that there are no laws connecting the mental and the neural, thus the anomalism of the mental. A paradox. So here's where we are. We've defended two widely accepted ideas, that causation involves laws, and now that there are no such laws connecting the mental and the physical. The conclusion seems inevitable, that there's no causation between the mental and the physical. Except for one thing. It seems just as widely accepted that there is such causation. In Lecture 7, we saw that mental-physical causation is both obvious and important. So we've got ourselves a paradox. Three widely accepted beliefs which seem inconsistent with each other. Fortunately, Davidson next offers a way out of that paradox. Its solution? Token identity. Let's be precise, Davidson urges. What the earlier argument rules out are mental-physical laws, laws which relate types of mental events with types of physical or neural events. But let's recall again from Lecture 4 that when philosophers discuss the identity between mental and physical events, they distinguish between identifying types of events and identifying particular individual token events. And what Davidson now suggests is this. We can preserve mental-physical causation if we look not at type identity, but at token identity. Let's see how this works. The first key point is this. We must recognize that the very same individual token event or thing can in general be described or labeled in many different ways. We might describe a particular event as, let's say, the Nazi invasion of Poland in 1939, and also as the start of World War II. We might describe a particular person as Andrew Pesson's favorite contemporary musician, or as that guy with the gravelly voice, or even by his name, Tom Waits. And similarly, we might describe some individual token event, both as Fred's thinking that philosophy is fun, and as Fred's neuron 17 firing rapidly. In each of these cases, we can have one single token individual, even if we can describe or identify that individual in many different ways. Next, Davidson observes, the very same event can fall under a law when described one way, but not when described other ways. To say that an event falls under a law is just to say that the law applies to or governs that event. So, for example, there may be a law about stopping at red lights, but the event of your planting your spring garden obviously doesn't fall under that law. Davidson's point, then, is that a given event may fall under a law of nature when the event is described one way, but not when it's described another way. So suppose Hurricane Katrina destroyed my iPod. The event of Andrew Pesson's iPod being destroyed does not fall under any relevant law, as there are no laws of nature which make reference to my iPod. There might, however, be other descriptions of this very same event, such that the event does fall under some relevant laws. If we describe that event in very basic physical terms, for example, the way the water molecules saturate the electrical components, or perhaps the way the wind blows the casing apart, then there probably are laws of the form. Whenever the wind and water operate such and such, then arrangements of certain molecules get affected in certain ways, and so on. Obviously, that last sentence would need to be specified more carefully, but the point is this. Describe the event as Pessin's iPod destruction, and no laws of nature apply to it, but describe it in some physical way as a specific set of physical processes, and laws of nature do apply to it. And these two points together, that a given event might have multiple descriptions and fall under a law with one description but not with others, provide Davidson with his solution to the paradox. If you want to say that a mental event causes a physical event, such as a brain event, then as we've seen, there must be a law connecting those two events. But Davidson has argued there are no mental physical laws. There are at most only purely physical laws, which relate physical events with other physical events. So if the mental event in question is to cause a physical event, it must be by virtue of it itself, the mental event itself, also being a physical event. Or to put that differently, the very same individual token event which can be described in mental language as Fred's thinking that philosophy is fun can also be described in physical language, Fred's neuron 17 firing rapidly. And insofar as that event can be described physically, it's also a physical event, and it can fall under purely physical laws and thus cause other physical events. An individual token mental state can cause an individual token physical state, in other words, if and only if the mental state is also, simultaneously, a physical state. So causation does require laws, but mental physical causation does not require laws specifically relating the mental and physical, for there are none. It just requires that individual mental events are themselves identical with individual physical events, for there are purely physical laws which can allow the causal processes. It requires, in other words, a token identity theory between the mental and the physical. Anomalous monism. Davidson's overall position here is known as anomalous monism. It's anomalous because he denies there are laws relating the mental and physical. And it's a monism because he's opposing the kind of dualism we spent much time discussing. Rather than believe that the mental and physical are utterly different kinds of things, it holds that all that really exists ultimately is one thing, the physical world with all its physical substances and properties. That's the monism, which comes from the Greek word monas, meaning one. All that exists is one kind of thing. But, and here is Davidson's key contribution, that one thing, that physical thing, can also frequently be described in mental terms, by mental descriptions. So reality is one, but our ways of describing it are two. Accept his view, and you can make sense of mental physical causation despite the absence of mental physical laws, or at least so he claims. This leads us to the new mind-body causation problem, version 1, anomalous monism. There's no doubt that Davidson's theory is very important, it's very original, and it's very influential. But to many philosophers now, it hasn't quite solved the problem it was at least partly designed to solve. We're looking for a way to explain how the mental and physical causally interact. On Davidson's view, mental events enter into causal relations with the physical only insofar as they also have physical properties and thus physical descriptions which figure into laws. So suppose your desire to drink causes you to get some water. On Davidson's view, the desire to drink must be redescribable physically, i.e. also be a physical event, and it does its causing by virtue of its being physical. But now here's the problem, or the new problem. The fact that this event is also a mental event, with mental properties and a mental description, a desire for water, seems to be completely irrelevant to its causing your body's motion towards water. It seems, in other words, that we're back to a kind of epiphenomenalism. Mental properties themselves are causally irrelevant. And so rather than preserve mental physical causation, Davidson seems to have reduced all causation to the relationship between physical properties, leaving the mental out of the causal picture altogether. So the new problem of mental-physical causation is this. Can we get mental properties to count as causally relevant, as causally efficacious, as having causal powers, as mental properties? And Davidson's account of the mental-physical causation issue seems, in the end, to say no. The new mind-body causation problem, version 2, extrinsicness of the mental. The same problem can be stated another way as well. Recall Lecture 9's discussion of computers and the computational theory of mind. Computers are composed of electrical circuits set up in causal ways so that when certain electrical signals are input, certain things happen, which we then interpret or assign meanings to. But the computer itself, as we saw, doesn't know what these electrical signals mean. So my laptop is set up such that by pressing a few keys, the words philosophy of mind appear on the screen, but the computer doesn't know what that means or that it's even a language. It's just a bunch of circuits set up doing electrical things. But now the same point applies to the computational theory of mind, of which Jerry Fodor's language of thought theory was the most important version. The mind on that theory is like a computer, where that means that intentional states are said to have both a syntax and a semantics. The syntax, recall, is the physical structure or the causal structure of the thing in question. In the computer, it concerns the electricity and physical laws governing the computer's operation, and in the mind, it will ultimately concern brain activity and neural laws. The semantics, to the contrary, is the meaning of the thing, what it's about, what our intentional states are about. And here's the problem. It seems in both contexts that it's the syntax that does all the causing. In the computer, the first electrical state causes the next electrical state, and it just doesn't matter what those states mean. The first would cause the second, even if they had different meanings or none at all. And the same thing applies in the language of thought. If the mind's like a computer, then it's the brain, the neural states, which do the causing, and the fact that these neural states might have a meaning or be about something seems irrelevant. That neural state would cause the next neural state, even if they had different meanings or none at all. In general, then, the causal powers of a given state are intrinsic to it. It's part of the very nature of the electrical states in the computer and the neural states in our brains that, conjoined with laws, they cause the subsequent states they cause. But the semantic aspects of these states seem to be extrinsic to them. That a given electrical or neural state has a meaning at all is not somehow built into the state itself, but at best a function of that state's relationship to things extrinsic to it, outside it. We saw this most vividly in Lecture 10's Twin Earth Thought Experiment, where we saw that two twins could be physical duplicates and yet their thoughts be about different things. So meaning seems to come from outside the states. And that, then, is the second version of the new mind-body causation problem. Meaning, and therefore the mental, seems to be an extrinsic feature of the physical states, but all the causation seems to be due to the intrinsic features of those states. Thus the mental, the fact that certain brain states have mental descriptions, a semantics, or about anything, seems causally irrelevant. The new mind-body causation problem, version 3, causal closure of the physical. Finally, a third version of the problem, which we've essentially seen before. It's this, that most scientists consider the physical world to be causally closed. That is, they believe that for any physical event, if you trace its causes and effects, you'll always stay within the physical. This assumption is crucial, it's thought, for the very possibility of physical science. For how could physics ever predict the motions of all the molecules in a domain if the mental could somehow intervene in those motions? And how could neuroscientists ever understand how the brain does what it does by looking at the brain if the mental were regularly interfering with brain activity? It seems, then, that the very nature of physical science rules out the mental's having any causal influence over the physical. Unless, of course, you hold that the mental just simply is itself physical in nature, as Davidson suggests. But then, as we've seen, you seem to make the mental causally irrelevant. All the causing is done by things, insofar as they're physical. Which amounts to saying that the mental is causally inert. In Lecture 7, we explored the historical dimension of the mind-body causation problem, focusing on substance dualism. In this lecture, we've been exploring the contemporary dimension of the problem, focusing on property dualism, and leaning, unfortunately, towards the conclusion that there seems to be no clear way for allowing mental events or properties, as mental, to have genuine causal influence in the physical realm. If the mental is to be understood as distinct in any sense from the physical, then, we seem to have to reject its causal efficacy and relevance. But to reject its causal efficacy and relevance, it seems to many, amounts to denying its reality altogether. In our final lecture, we'll look at various versions of eliminativism, the view which denies the reality of the mental, and it's to that that we will now turn.
This ends Lecture 13.